support the work we do here all year round. Please continue to support KPFK, all the vital work that's done at this Pacifica station. Call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK and join the KPFK Sustainer Circle, or you can give at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I'm Lucy Kang. Today, we're going to Houston, Texas, where a group of moms sued the Department of Housing and Urban Development because they failed to maintain their properties.
We have sewage water. Literally, right now, if you stand right here in the parking lot, you can smell our complex. Everything just smells like sewage. Kids can't go out and play because of the sewage water, which is also seeping in through the floors.
And we're going to hear how community members in Puerto Rico stepped up to restore power and provide housing in the wake of Hurricane Maria. They aren't just working in isolation, though. Community leaders in Puerto Rico are collaborating with organizers from across the Gulf Coast to learn from one another and advance their shared work for just recovery.
We just hope these relationships are durable and they keep lasting. And, you know, 5 years from now, there might be another disaster in Texas. There might be another one in Louisiana, and we need to keep that network open. Fortunately, we have models that we could look back now and say, you know what, it didn't work in this or that situation, or it created more inequalities. So we need that community-based focus to make this work and count.
Stay with us. I'm Lucy King. You're listening to Making Contact. Today's story is from our partners of the podcast, But Next Time. It's the third in a four-part series we're playing all through December. If you haven't listened to the first episodes, now's your chance to go to our website or your favorite podcast platform to get caught up. This series tells the story of several disasters, wildfires, the COVID-19 pandemic, and hurricanes. These difficult events pull back the curtain on long-standing inequities in our society. But you're also going to hear the way the people most affected have organized response and recovery and how they're rebuilding towards a more just, equitable future. The series is hosted by community organizers Chriselle Pillay and Rose Arrieta. Here's Rose to start us off.
In our previous episodes, we learned about how communities in Northern California had responded to climate-fueled wildfires and the pandemic. In Sonoma County's wine country, and in my neighborhood in San Francisco's Mission District. Now we're headed to Texas, where Chriselle has lived most of her life.
After Hurricane Harvey in 2017, my family moved from the suburbs to our old neighborhood, Cashmere Gardens, in Northeast Houston. It's historically African American, and honestly, many have given up on the place. We moved into my aunt's home to keep it in the family, but once we were there, I couldn't ignore all the problems I confronted when I walked out my front door. Hurricane Harvey was a huge storm. It rained hard for 3 days straight, and it also flooded a third of the city. And while affluent parts of the city were starting to bounce back, my neighbors still had to deal with mold in their walls and leaky roofs. I now lead an organization that addresses equity in disaster recovery. And we focus on Houston, but I've become so connected with people across the country who are working on these issues.
Hello?
Okay, now you can hear me.
In October 2019, I helped lead a tour of Houston for affordable housing advocates from around the country.
But we are no stranger to disaster. We've used many of our lessons that we've learned from past disasters to try to really shift the way in which we recover.
We have all had to confront discrimination in the disaster recovery process that leaves people with fewer resources and much worse off than their wealthier neighbors. Zoe Middleton organized the tour.
So I'm the Southeast Texas and Houston co-director for Texas Housers, and we're a civil rights organization that does civil rights by doing fair housing and equitable disaster recovery.
The passengers on this tour included advocates from Texas, Puerto Rico, Florida, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C., all connected to the National Low Income Housing Coalition.
Several organizations, after the storm waters went down, came together and said, okay, how can we work together this time? Why don't we really make an effort to work more comprehensively and more strategically, as opposed to us all working in our little areas?
Hello, everyone. My name is Erica Bowman. I am the community organizer with Texas Housers. This apartment complex that's across the street is called Carpentrium. It is a project-based Section 8 property that we've been working with. They have a natural disaster every time it rains in their home. It pours constantly.
Erica has spent countless hours getting to know the families in this sprawling cluster of two-story buildings. When she describes Copper Tree as a Section 8 property, she's saying that the federal government helps provide affordable housing for these families, mostly single moms with children. The corporate owners received millions from the government to accept Section 8 vouchers from the renters. The owners of this old development from the 1970s get market rate. The federal government pays the difference between that and what the tenants can pay.
Copper Tree doesn't rise to the level of national attention or even local media attention, or it's a chronic, slow-moving disaster.
The conditions here are really bad. The mold is deep inside of the walls. It's very evident when you walk into these homes that this mold is creating a lot of very, very serious illnesses inside of this apartment complex.
Through the windows of the tour bus, we could see that the Copper Tree development occupies several blocks. There are more than 300 apartments. And driving through, I remember seeing one burnt-out building left abandoned. Others were just falling apart with mold and water damage. Erica knows more intimately about life inside this complex for the families here.
This is Jamie. She has started to help organize the women that are in this apartment complex. I'm going to let her talk a little bit about some of the things that she's faced living on this property.
Hello, I'm Jamie. I'm a full-time student, full-time employee, full-time mom of five. I moved to Copper Tree in 2011. It didn't rain, it poured, like the walls would peel. So every couple of months they have to put new sheetrock. They don't kill the mold.
And instead of ripping and taking things out, they leave the same exact carpet that's been there forever. They paint over mold, over leaks, and then within days, you start to see the same mold.
My three babies that live with me, two of them have severe asthma. I go through a box of albuterol per child per month, and that's in a good month. They can't breathe. I called the office. They tell me they're going to come look at it, and a year later, no, nothing. They move me to another.
Like a lot of these women who don't have any type of renter insurance, she lost a lot of her furniture. She lost a lot of the clothes.
It's really important that we understand who is able to recover as a renter, and it's not low-income renters. Fair housing wage in Houston is something around $17 an hour to be able to afford one-bedroom apartment. They have no place to go, or they're forced into places that are of especially substandard housing stock.
We have sewage water. Literally, right now, if you stand right here in the parking lot, you can smell our complex. Everything just smells like sewage. Kids can't go out and play because of the sewage water, which is also seeping in through the floors. I know of two residents that have moved.
Jamie is part of a campaign called 12 Moms, one result of tenant organizing in Southeast Texas. The moms have sued the government, HUD to be exact, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, because they have failed to maintain property or cancel contracts with landlords who won't make repairs.
12 Moms is a fair housing campaign that seeks to put the people that are actually experiencing the insufficient and unsafe housing conditions and at the forefront of the campaigns where they are able to ask for the solutions that they want.
Jamie, she still is trying to figure out ways of how not only can she get her family out of there, but how she can get others. Her being part of this 12 Moms campaign started to open her eyes as how the system works and what needs to be done.
Tenants are asking for vouchers to be able to move to a safer area.
Zoe explained, it's hard to look for housing with a HUD voucher, especially where we live.
the state of Texas has said that voucher holders can be discriminated against because they're not under the Fair Housing Act, a protected class. If a landlord does not want to have a voucher holder, they can simply say no, and it's because of how you pay your rent. We're kind of the Wild West in terms of our respect for capital, but not human life.
There's like this cycle when it comes to, you know, property owner, landlord, management, HUD, but it leaves the tenant just totally out of it. Mm-hmm. But the tenant is the one that's supposed to be served. These developments should not exist solely as commodities that are just revenue generating machines. And that's in essence what they've become.
HUD could do so much differently. I think it won't come as a surprise to anyone, but I think that first they could refuse to re-grant to property owners that have low inspection scores. HUD could also be futuristic by looking at where floodplains lie. There are hundreds of thousands of tenants in project-based Section 8 housing that live at risk of serious flooding, and HUD could refuse to subsidize siting people in the floodplain.
The ultimate win would have been HUD coming in and giving these vouchers to the women, letting them know, we do see that you are living in hazardous conditions. Obviously, management isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing. And so we are now issuing vouchers for opportunity to find housing in other areas. That's not what happened.
Erica said HUD passed the responsibility onto the local housing authority that, in turn, gave vouchers to some families in the same area. All of those renters had to find apartments within a very short time without any financial help from government agencies.
HUD, they kind of just put their hands up and let them kind of fend for themselves.
A nationwide study from 2019 revealed that about 450,000 renter households in public housing or privately owned subsidized housing are in floodplains. This situation can only get worse with climate change.
So if there's anybody in here today that can speak for us and help us get a little further with our voice, please, we're begging you. Some of us need help to help ourselves. Thank you.
So Jamie's super brave. I think anyone that decides to participate in organizing work in a state like Texas on an issue that is so underprotected, like tenants' rights are in Texas, is doing something really brave, because you will hear stories of people being threatened to be evicted. They'll get a comment that's like, are you not going to cause any trouble, are you?
I asked a couple of the tenants who are wanting to express themselves to hang SOS little white rags of stating, like, this is extreme emergency. I just wanted you to just get a visual of that and feel the voices of those families that are in these apartments and that are living the way that they're living. So,
and hopefully it'll get the attention of people, because we're embarrassing the city council. You know, they got these flags in their district that's flying. Obviously, you guys aren't doing something that you're supposed to be doing. You need to pay attention to that.
Erica described the day she helped tenant families put up the flags. One very curious little girl asked what she was doing.
I was super excited to tell her because she was so eager. So I was like, these are the voices of the people who live here. This is saying that in my apartment, I have mold. And she goes, I have mold. And I was like, you do? And she's like, yeah, I have mold. This is saying water is coming from my ceiling. Water is coming from my ceiling. This is telling people, like, this is not fair, that this is how my house looks. And something needs to be done about it. He's smiling like, okay, I'm getting it. I get what you're saying. I always tell them on kids, like, if you see something that's not right, don't accept it. There's never a time where you can't use your voice. Your voice is your freedom.
We'll learn about the outcomes of the lawsuit brought by the moms in Coppertree. Their efforts are a step toward holding the federal government responsible for safe, sanitary, and dignified living conditions. A few months after we gathered in Houston, Zoe and I and colleagues from other cities traveled together to Puerto Rico. An environmental grantmakers group had invited us to their conference to speak together on a panel about what our organizations have learned about disaster recovery.
Hello, my name is Kashana Hill. I'm executive director of the Louisiana Fair Housing Action Center based in New Orleans.
I'd come to know Kashana Hill through our work on fair housing in the South.
So I'm missing Mardi Gras to be here with you all. And I'm going to ask that you excuse any residual glitter that you might see on my face, because I know it's still there. It was pointed out to me twice in the airport yesterday, and you know, there's nothing I can do about it.
Ariadna Goudreau, who runs a legal advocacy organization in Puerto Rico, had been on our Houston bus tour, and we were all eager to reconnect with her on the island.
Hi, I'm Ariadna Goudreau. I am the founder and director of Ayuda Legal Puerto Rico, which is a local organization that works with movement lawyering initiatives around just recovery and the right to dignified housing. We were the first disaster legal aid initiative on the ground the day after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, and since then we have...
Hurricane Maria wrecked Puerto Rico just a few weeks after Harvey hit Houston. Maria was a major hurricane that caused close to 3,000 deaths on the island, and the recovery had been painfully slow. It's still going on as we record this in fall 2021.
Half of the adults in the U.S. don't know that Puerto Ricans are citizens. They've had U.S. citizenship since 1917, but it's a qualified, unequal form of citizenship. Puerto Ricans cannot even vote in U.S. presidential elections, or even elect their own senators and representatives to Congress. At the same time, the U.S. imposed austerity measures and cut services, creating hardship and huge obstacles to disaster recovery.
I learned a lot about that reality from Ariadna and others at the conference.
When does a disaster start? And it's a very difficult question. I know it is for all of us. I'm thinking in the case of Puerto Rico, the backdrop of colonialism, the backdrop of austerity, sustained austerity for the past 16 years, the backdrop of human rights violations. And then Hurricane Maria came in. And the recovery process has been also a process of fighting for the right to stay on the land. If you need to move away from this place, you need to leave the island, to actually leave the homeland.
One of the people in our small network of housing justice advocates at the conference was Luis Gallardo. I was intrigued by what I heard him say about his involvement in the right to housing movement in Puerto Rico. We met in a park to continue our conversation.
Ever since I was a teenager, I would always wonder, how do we have people living on the street? The Maria situation only made it more intense, because now you have folks who lost their house, or they live in substandard housing, worse than we'd ever imagined. They have nowhere to go. They have no title. They don't have access to FEMA assistance. The federal money is just not arriving. We saw abandoned schools that were occupied by families that created sort of communal settings where they would, you know, divide up the classrooms, and that's where we'd stay for shelter. So we saw an explosion of that occur.
So Luis co-directs Centro para la Reconstrucción del Habitat. It transforms abandoned buildings into affordable housing. And yes, you heard him correctly. Many families are denied FEMA assistance. And that's because on the island, homeowners who inherit property are not required to have a deed to their homes. And FEMA requires that in order for homeowners to even get help.
In the aftermath of a disaster, Puerto Ricans would be hard-pressed to retroactively create deeds to homes that have been passed down generation to generation. So they get left out. Again. Luis explained that disaster recovery on the island requires a lot of creativity.
We don't march into a community and say, hey, everybody, let's take over an abandoned building. Like, what building do you want to take out? We are approached, or we find these samples of community-based action. And I think Puerto Rico is a great laboratory for that, especially considering the disasters it had and the lack of a local, state, or federal response. We had to find our own shelters. We had to find our own housing. We had to clear our own roads, and we had to create our own networks of services, food, water, and basic necessities.
Oscar Lopez Rivera, a renowned Puerto Rican activist and former political prisoner, told the story of San Sebastian to illustrate how people took things into their own hands when the government didn't show up for them.
A big part of Hurricane Maria recovery was the worst electrical blackout in U.S. history that lasted several months.
In my hometown, the mayor, he brought all the retired workers from the electric company. And in 2 weeks, San Sebastian had electricity. One of the few places in Puerto Rico that had electricity. And it was done by the workers.
The success in San Sebastian led to new laws in Puerto Rico that empower local governments during emergencies to restore critical services on their own.
There are examples like this all over the island of people taking care of each other. On a stormy day, we had the opportunity to see organizing in motion beyond the shiny conference venues and tourist maps. Ariadna and others encouraged us to visit the Caño Martín Peña, 8 densely populated neighborhoods of San Juan surround this tidal channel. In the early 1900s, people built informal dwellings along the channel in the mangrove wetlands. As the city grew, the channel became clogged and polluted. Often, it overflows into the homes of these neighborhoods. 7 of us, including me, Zoe, and Kashana, squeezed into a van with our guides, Maria Ibeliz Inerio and Marioga Julia Pacheco.
So there's no air conditioner in the in the van, so we are so sorry for that because we have to close all the windows for the rain.
But you're gonna see with your own eyes in this tour what is the struggle of the communities when rains like it's raining today.
Through the steamy windows, we could see the streets filling with flood water. The modest homes and storefronts were bright blue and yellow, like the majestic ones we had seen in other areas. People were navigating past storm-damaged buildings and empty lots.
This is the Martin Peña Barbosa Bridge. This is one of the two bridges that connect one side of the community, the north and the south. Both sides of the district, they get flooded. Also, it is a health issue because of the contamination.
So I'm from New Orleans, and one of the same kinds of issues, just any sort of rain, lots of water in the streets and flooding. Like, are you still dealing with the same infrastructure from like 100 years ago, or has there been like recent upgrades or anything to the systems?
No, that's why we are here, because the community designed a comprehensive plan to update and to build for the first time a lot of infrastructure that we here don't have. We receive the water from all the communities around, but here don't have the infrastructure to deal with all the water that comes to this place. At the same time,
what we learned was quite amazing, that more than 700 meetings and activities generated plans to revitalize the Caño neighborhoods. That's empowered people to lead and carry out these plans through 3 institutions, including a community land trust, or CLT. The land trust provides more than 2,000 families the legal right to live on the land where their homes stand and resettle those who live in flood-prone areas.
And as you can see, we have to relocate a lot of families. So this is one of the construction is occurring right now, the new houses. This particularly is for a person that lost their house in the hurricane.
Almost 1,000 people in the Caño Martín Peña neighborhood will be relocated to new homes. Their plan includes removing debris and pollution from the waterways and creating parks. People hope the channel will become a center for recreation and transportation in the city, instead of a dumping ground for San Juan's runoff and pollution.
We're going to pass through this bridge. This is a historic bridge. It was constructed when we were a colony from Spain. We're now a colony from the U.S. So it's just a change of colony, but it's colony. So it was
the day after our visit to El Caño, the sun had finally come out. Zoe and I took a walk to a nearby park to share what we experienced.
Driving through those narrow streets with little flood infrastructure was pretty nerve-wracking, where the folks in the van were, clutching their heart at some moments at times because it looks as if, they were diving in the water at some point. If the community here in El Caño didn't do it for themselves, would there even still be homes in that area?
Home is really a place to belong and to build your sense of self and to
understand how you fit into it, all of these larger systems, into your family, into your neighborhood. But at its core, home is about who gets to belong, who gets to remain. So disaster recovery is when it destroys your home, when it destroys a neighborhood. How we recover is also about who gets to belong and who gets to survive this disaster and who gets to survive the next disaster and how they get to survive it.
It felt precious in Puerto Rico to build these relationships with our peers. We weren't trying to impress a funder or plead with the government agency. We could just reflect on what was common and what was unique in our own experiences in our cities. If we could build on that, how different things could be. Luis Gallardo shared our hope that we could continue to build on our collective knowledge and experiences.
We just hope these relationships are durable and they keep lasting. And, you know, 5 years from now, there might be another disaster in Texas. There might be another one in Louisiana. And we need to keep that network open. Fortunately, we have models that we could look back now and say, you know what, it didn't work in this or that situation, or it created more inequalities. So we need that community-based focus to make this work and count.
There was something that someone said the first day that we were here. Resistance is really strong in Puerto Rico. I think it's really beautiful, da da da. But every beautiful story shouldn't have to be about resistance. Mm-hmm. And that really, really spoke to me because I think we find a lot of comfort in our organizing work in Houston. It's like how we help to make sense of disaster, right? And how we find a way through it. But like we also deserve the peace of mind and the comfort and the other types of beautiful stories that are out there that feel really far away when you're dealing with even a regular rain causing a flood, let alone a hurricane causing a flood.
All facts. It shouldn't be a luxury to just lead our lives, all of us, regardless of whether we have a lot of money. Zoe and I, and so many others, do our work because, as a country, the U.S. just can't get it together. We aren't there yet. Even after a record number of pandemic deaths and major job losses that have pushed millions of people to the margins.
Even then, though, like Chriselle's colleague Erica said, there's never a time when you can't use your voice. We'll have more to say about what happens when people use their voices to resist, vote, and organize for better living conditions. We're Chriselle Pillay and Rose Arrieta.
But Next Time is a project of Rise Home Stories. For more information, visit risehomestories.com. Since the 2021 broadcast of this episode, Chriselle Pillay has continued to collaborate with Ayuda Legal to press for equitable disaster preparedness and recovery. In 2022, Chriselle shared insight from her experience in Houston with Ayuda Legal on a panel entitled El Techo es un Derecho, or Housing is a Right.
Disaster recovery is just the lens that we use to really expose the long-standing inequities and discriminatory practices that we've seen for generations. What good is it rebuilding a home when it's just going to flood again?
Chriselle explained that voters in Houston pushed for a $2.5 billion bond to be accompanied by billions more in federal and state funds and a community flood resilience task force, which prioritizes the needs of vulnerable residents and advises county officials on the creation of a, quote, comprehensive, innovative, and community-driven plan for resilience. As board member of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, Chriselle presented Ayuda Legal with the 2023 Sheila Crowley Housing Justice Award. The organization was praised for, quote, its persistent efforts to ensure a just recovery, including access to safe and affordable housing in the aftermath of numerous disasters.
Support comes from the Peacock Theater in downtown L.A., presenting Mel Brooks, Saturday, July 27th at 7:30 p.m. for a celebration of the 50th anniversary of his iconic comedy classic, Blazing Saddles.
He rode a blazing saddle, he wore a shining star.
dark.
This special event features a live interview, an audience Q&A with the Peabody, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award-winning 98-year-old Mel Brooks, following a full-length screening of Blazing Saddles on the big screen. For further information and tickets, visit peacocktheater.com and kpfk.org.
With the new car business down right now, you might think that we don't need your vehicle donation. However, the market for donated vehicles is very strong. Please donate your old car, truck, RV, or motorcycle to us at 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Or online at kpfk.org. We'll take care of everything, and you'll help support the quality programming you hear on KPFK. Just call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Or donate online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
I'm Amy Gastelum. This week we're following up on a story about self-managed abortion that we produced last spring. A lot has changed since then, and we're here to catch you up. That said, post-Roe abortion care access is changing daily in the U.S. right now. This story is being produced for broadcast in April 2024. Things may have changed by the time you hear it.
After the Arizona Supreme Court upheld a Civil War-era abortion ban on Tuesday, Democrats in the state legislature tried to open debate on a bill that would repeal the 1864 law, but they were blocked by Republicans, who cut them off and quickly adjourned for the week. It led to this chaotic scene on the State House floor.
All in favor of that motion, vote aye.
Aye.
All opposed, vote no. Ayes have it, so ordered.
Arizona recently joined several other states severely restricting abortion care, mostly in the South and Midwest. Since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade in June 2022, access to legal abortion care has varied widely depending on the region of the country. Some states, like California, have protected legal access to abortion care by making it part of their state constitution. Other states, like Indiana, where I live, have created bans so restrictive it's almost impossible to qualify for a legal abortion here. But networks for helping people find abortion care are robust and, in many ways, growing.
Hi, this is Jess from All Options and the Hoosier Fund.
You may remember Jessica Marchbank from the story on self-managed abortion we published last year. She's the state programs director at All Options Pregnancy Resource Center in Bloomington, Indiana. In this recording from 2023, she's in her office on the phone, following up with someone who needed funds for her abortion care.
Oh, good. Are you all set? You don't need any additional financial assistance? Okay. Oh, that's fantastic. I'm really, really happy to hear that. If anything changes, don't hesitate to get in touch and we'll be here, okay?
At the time, Jess would often refer callers like this to clinics in Indiana for care, but not anymore. Indiana's abortion ban went into effect in August 2023. There are a few narrow exemptions, but the law is so restrictive that abortion clinics like Planned Parenthood and Whole Woman's Health aren't providing abortion care in Indiana at all. I am curious, you know, in terms of the logistics. I mean, since August 2023, like, how has that affected your work? What's changed?
I mean, in some ways, it's really simple and very little has changed. And of course, in other ways, everything has changed because now the vast majority of people are not going to be able to access an abortion within the state they live in.
It's a huge blow, but it wasn't a walk in the park before the ban went into effect.
So, leading up to the ban taking effect in Indiana, access to abortion care in-state had gotten pretty bad.
Rules like gestational age limits, mandatory counseling, and laws aimed at restricting how clinics operate already made it hard to get an abortion in Indiana. The Hoosier Abortion Access Study showed that even before the ban, about 1 in 4 Hoosiers who needed an abortion were already traveling out of state for care. Now it's even worse in Indiana. I'll just say that I looked at Abortion Finder, you know, to see like, okay, if I'm 6 weeks pregnant, you know, where do I need to go? Like, how can I do this? And it was such a fascinating journey to be like, okay, well, the closest clinic to me is in Cincinnati, but
you'll have to go there twice.
You have to go there twice. Yeah. I can't be a minor. But if I go to Champaign, everything changes. If I go west to Illinois, I can be a minor and I don't have to do the counseling.
Right.
And it's up to, I think, 24 weeks gestation, whereas in Ohio, it's 22.
Right.
So it was like, wow. I mean, east or west makes a huge difference.
Oh, it definitely does. A lot of our callers are from the Indianapolis area. So right off the top of my head, if they say they're going to Dayton, we always, clinic choice is always up to the individual, but we want to make sure that they have all of the information. So it's almost, depending on where they are in Indianapolis, it could be almost the same distance between them and Dayton and them and Champaign. Sometimes they'll say, well, you know, Champaign's 5 miles farther away. And I'll say, but you only have to go there once. and that really does make a huge difference to a lot of folks. Sometimes they'll choose to go even further and go up to Chicago because there are numerous clinics in Chicago, and sometimes it's easier to get a fast appointment up that way, even if it means they're driving farther.
This running around to find abortion healthcare is more than many people can do. In-clinic abortion care costs a lot, around $600, and often requires time off from work. Childcare and transportation are also major barriers for some. Forcing people to travel further for care means some folks just aren't going to get it. And as Jess said, these barriers have existed long before the Dobbs decision in 2022.
Yes, Roe gave us the legal protection to get an abortion, to have an abortion. But, you know, so many people did not have real access to abortion, right?
Dr. Melissa Madeira is a researcher and consultant on lots of projects related to abortion access. She says people who have the hardest time getting care are those who live far from a city, are marginalized by gender identity, race, or immigration status.
And many people, many people do not have the financial ability to access abortion. So we have to really think about that. Yes, Roe gave us legal access to abortion, but it didn't actually give us all access to abortion all the time whenever we needed it. I think what's really important to think about is that we need multiple avenues to abortion care. Not one way is the right way for everyone, right? And even in states where abortion is still accessible, and I hate using the word legal or, you know, talking about legalities because I don't want to give the law any real legitimacy because it's not legitimate. Like this is not legitimate, right? And so we need various ways, various avenues for people to access abortion. And we should start thinking about how do we construct that for the day in which everyone in every state will be able to access abortion or have legal access to abortion. Again, using the word legal.
The problem of legal abortion care access is old. It's older than Dobbs. It's older than Roe. But self-managed abortion is also old. People have been managing their own abortions for thousands of years using herbs, teas, and other methods passed down from families and cultural traditions. These days, self-managed abortion is usually done using the same medications that doctors use for abortions, mifepristone and misoprostol. In 2022, the World Health Organization stated outright that it's safe for a person to manage their own first trimester abortion without a clinician's help. Whether you get these pills in person from a doctor or order them online, the effect is the same. Here's how it works.
There are two types of abortion available: surgical and medical. In this video, we will focus on medical abortion. Medical abortion, often referred to as the abortion pill, is a safe and effective way of ending a pregnancy. The pill is usually taken within the first 12 weeks of gestation. The whole process can take up to 2 weeks to complete, although most women feel normal again after just 2 days. Depending on the method, it can be up to 98% effective. How does it work? Medical abortion can consist of two types of medication, mifepristone and misoprostol. Using a combination of both is the most effective method. Mifepristone works by blocking progesterone, a hormone necessary to maintain a pregnancy, while misoprostol works by causing the uterus to contract and empty. The combination method requires one mifepristone pill followed by four misoprostol pills 24 to 48 hours later. If mifepristone is not available, misoprostol can be taken on its own. This method is slightly less effective. When taking misoprostol alone, 12 pills are to be taken within a 12-hour period. Four every 3 hours is the recommended procedure to follow. What can you expect from a medical abortion? Misoprostol causes cramping and bleeding to empty the uterus. It can feel like a heavy period, and it's not uncommon to pass large blood clots during the process. Side effects can include diarrhea and vomiting, tiredness, mild fever or chills, headaches, and dizziness. To ease pain and discomfort, some of the following may help. Staying at home or in a comfortable space when taking the pills, taking ibuprofen or painkillers before the procedure, having a hot bath or shower, ensuring a friend or family member present to help reassure and comfort you, having an emergency plan in place for any potential complications. Urgent medical advice will need to be sought if you experience excess heavy bleeding, if more than two pads are filled per hour for 2 hours, intense pain, continuous vomiting, a fever of higher than 38 degrees Celsius that persists for longer than 12 hours. What happens next? This will depend on each woman's individual experience. Most women can expect tiredness, cramping, and bleeding for a few days. Within 24 to 48 hours, most women feel fine to return to their daily routine. Although it is not essential, it is advisable to plan a follow-up appointment with a health provider 2 weeks after the procedure. They can confirm if the process was successful and discuss your contraceptive options. What happens to periods? Periods should return to normal 4 to 6 weeks after taking the pills. If it does not return, a pregnancy test should be taken to confirm there are no longer signs of a pregnancy. How soon can sex be resumed? Sex can be resumed as soon as you feel ready. Pregnancy can happen soon after medical abortion, so it is advisable to talk with a health provider about the right contraception for you. To find out more information on the options available in your nearest clinic, please visit www.ippf.org. You can also visit www.womenonweb.org for further information on medical abortion.
While traditional in-clinic access to abortion care is increasingly difficult across the U.S., activists around the country are working to get people the care they need, especially in the form of pills. One online hub is PlanCPills.org. Here's Dr. Melissa Madera again. She's helped the organization with some research projects.
2015, that's when Plan C was founded. Yeah, so it's been a long time. I mean, before the access issues got the worst, which is right now, 7 years ago, they were seven, 8 years ago, right? We're in 2023 now. They were thinking, the co-founders were thinking, like, how can we let people know more about how to get abortion pills online? Because people have been doing this and using abortion pills on their own, self-managing in other countries for many, many years. So the thought was, oh, this is something that's happening globally. People in the U.S. should also know about it, because we all know that even though we had the right to an abortion, many people didn't have access to abortion. So the question is, how can we get more access to people? And abortion pills is one of those ways. So yeah, it's been a long time that this team has been working on making sure that people know how to access abortion pills online and to manage their abortion safely. And it's the most comprehensive guide to abortion pills on the interwebs. So you can go online and search very specifically for your state. They give you information on where to get pills, how to order them, and then resources around if you have questions about the medical aspects of things while you're self-managing, if you have questions about the legal aspects of things, also resources for those.
Here in Indiana, if I go to plancpills.org, I can order pills online from Aid Access, Abuzz, and Cambridge Reproductive Health Consultants. If I choose one of these, I would receive virtual support from a clinician if I need it, and it costs around $150. No travel necessary. But there are also 25 other sites listed. Some provide abortion pills for as little as $0. That's right, free 99. Those sites do not offer clinician support, but plancpills.org also links out to the miscarriage and abortion hotline, a phone and text hotline staffed by abortion care providers. Here's Dr. Marrera again.
And for some people, like, they want to use these pills and they are like, oh, I know it's safe and I can do this on my own. Some people are like, well, I don't really want to do that. And you know what? It also has to do with your circumstances, right? Because if you are someone who can't take days off of work, or feel like, you know, I really have to like be home with my kids, you might want to go to a clinic, get a procedure and go back home and it's done, right? And so one of the most important things to me is like, we need to trust people, right? To make the right decision that is good for them based on their own circumstances, right? So people are going to make their decisions based on like, how much money I have, where I live, can I take time off of work? I have kids. You know, it's like there's so many ways in which people have to like come to this decision on their own. And we need to respect that and give them all the options so they can do the right thing for them.
Self-managed abortion isn't for everyone, but plancpills.org fills a gap and proves a movement. It shows that folks are still working hard to get abortion care to people who need it. Other sites like the Repro Legal Helpline and abortionfinder.org also help people navigate this confusing time. But none of these sites can replace what local abortion funds do in terms of boots on the ground. Local orgs know the laws in their states. They create networks between each other to get their people's needs met. They even advocate at the local legislative level. After the Dobbs decision, All Options was part of the group that sued the state of Indiana over an abortion ban. That action led to an injunction that lasted until August 2023, That meant abortion care could continue for about a year. It gave networks a chance to plan how to operate after the ban would go into effect. Here's Jess from All Options in Bloomington again.
So if we back up 2 years in time, let's go back to that, shall we? 2 years ago, right. Well, it still wasn't a walk in the park, but 2 years ago, we as the All Options Hoosier Abortion Fund, I think we had working relationships with maybe 20 different abortion care providers, mostly in Indiana, and then a few in like Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, and then like the DuPont Clinic and a clinic in Colorado. And we were in partnership with other regional abortion funds, but not, it was more allyship, but we didn't really work closely together. So between the Dobbs ruling and until our ban took effect, we really just doubled down on making sure that we were really well connected to everyone we needed to be connected to. So we now have working relationships with over 60 abortion care providers in 9 different states.
Wow.
So I believe we're working with every single clinic in Illinois, most in Michigan, most in Ohio, and the majority of Hoosiers really are going to Illinois at this point, but plenty still go to Ohio and Michigan. We're really fortunate to really build those relationships with the other abortion funds. And my heart just feels really full when I think about how we can lean on each other. The Chicago Abortion Fund, Kentucky Health Justice Network, Abortion Fund of Ohio, and Midwest Access Coalition. We have like private signal groups with all of the different funds. We have ways to reach out directly to say, hey, we're supporting this caller who needs extensive support. We can do this much. Can you do the rest?
Meaning funding.
funding and practical support, childcare, meals, rides, hotels, things like that.
So there are volunteers helping with these kinds of things, or is it like more funding?
Sometimes volunteers, sometimes it's cash assistance or a gas card.
Okay.
A Lyft or Uber. Depends on the region and whatever fund is working with them. We are still, because we are small, we are focused on abortion funding, procedural funding. We don't really have the capacity to do more like cash assistance right now. But even so, for years and years, the Chicago Abortion Fund and Midwest Access Coalition have already been covering Indiana with that type of support and doing it well. You know, they have the infrastructure already. And I appreciate them so much because going into this year, we knew that we wouldn't be able to sustain the level of funding that we had through, like, from mid-2022 until really until the ban took effect in August of 23. We were flooded with unprecedented levels of donations. That's what allowed us to go from funding 30 people a month to, for a couple of months, hundreds of people in a month. It was because we had more money. Those donations have dwindled. People have stopped rage giving. I think a lot of Americans think, oh, the crisis is over. Like, what more really can be done? Which is like, no, the crisis is not over. And in fact, in some ways, it's really just getting going.
I'm Salima Hamrani. You're listening to Making Contact and a story about self-managed abortion in the United States. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at radioproject.org, where you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. And now, back to the show with Amy Castellan.
We will hear argument this morning in case 23-235, the Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine and the consolidated case. General Prelliger.
In March, the Supreme Court heard opening arguments in a case that could make it illegal for anyone to use mifepristone for abortion care, including providers in states where abortion is legal. Remember, mifepristone blocks the hormone progesterone, essentially ending a pregnancy. Misoprostol causes cramping that empties the uterus. It is possible to use misoprostol alone for an abortion, but it's more effective to use both drugs.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. FDA approved mifepristone based on the agency's scientific judgment that the drug is safe and effective. It's maintained that judgment across five presidential administrations, and millions of Americans have used mifepristone to safely end their pregnancies. Respondents may not agree with that choice, but that doesn't give them Article III standing or a legal basis to upend the regulatory scheme.
If the Food and Drug Administration loses this case, abortion care for everyone will change dramatically. More than half of all abortions performed in the U.S. are done using mifepristone and misoprostol. Meanwhile, local abortion funds are working this issue from all angles, leaning on one another. They're advocating at legislative levels. All Options has sued the state. Again, they're trying to expand the exemptions for legal abortion in Indiana. They're also coming up with creative ways to get people sexual health care. This month, All Options teamed up with the Midwest Action Coalition and Indiana Task Force to install an emergency contraception vending machine. It's located at the rear of a general store called Dear Mom on Indianapolis's Near East Side, a neighborhood where one in every four people lives in poverty. Besides emergency contraception, the hand-painted machine holds all kinds of sexual health supplies, condoms, dental dams, and pregnancy tests.
My grandmother is from Kentucky.
The shop hosted a launch party for it. In one video posted to social media, a group of about 25 gathers in the store.
Your new best friend.
And as they chat, a woman in a red t-shirt pushes a button on the vending machine while her friend records. A small green Plan B box drops. The woman reaches through the door flap, pulls out the box, and poses, smiling for her friend.
Projects like this are hyper-local, and Jess says continuing to support local abortion funds is more important than ever.
Someone who is a strong supporter of All Options and has been for years as a donor and supporter and advocate messaged me on Facebook, I think when it was announced that the ban was going to take effect. And she was basically like, hey, do you have any recommendations on where I should donate my money now since you won't be able to do anything? And I was like, wait. The only thing that has changed is that we're not helping people. We're generally not helping people access abortions in Indiana.
In Indiana. You're referring them out.
Yeah. There's nothing that prevents us from paying for a Hoosier to get an abortion in any of the legal states.
What do you think that people can be doing to help folks get access to abortion or to advocate for it in a red state like Indiana or in a state like Mississippi?
There are things people can do. I do think generally if people are able to donate dollars, donating to grassroots organizations who are actively working in advocacy and access is really important. Like specifically within Indiana, donating to someone like All Options, it makes a real impact. Like I get a $50 donation from a local person, and I can imagine a larger organization being like, oh, $50. I'm like, oh, $50. I can buy two cases of diapers. You know, like I know exactly where that money is going to go to, and I can picture the family that it's going to go to, or, you know, to abortion funding, which is sort of this never ending stream of need. People will continue to get pregnant and not want to be so. And so really donating to any organization that is in the fight for access and making abortion more accessible to all people is something I'll always advocate for. Likewise, donating time to any of organizations like All Options, Keep Our Clinics, even I Need an A. I think they have some different volunteer opportunities, and those sites are vital in helping people access care.
All right. What else should people know about abortion access right now in Indiana?
I think the refrain that I've been sort of broadcasting for the last 18 months is, first, don't give up hope. You can get an abortion. It's not just us. There are teams of people who are here to help people get the care they need and deserve, whatever that is. So I don't want people to feel like that sense of confusion, disinformation, and misinformation. Don't let that keep you from exercising your rights and your choices and your agency as a human being. But it's also okay to be angry and to say, this is not okay. And I want my lawmakers to know this. I want my lawmakers to know that they acted specifically against the desires of the people of Indiana mm-hmm. when they enacted this ban. And I think people need to continue to vote and to contact their legislators to express how they feel about this. To say that the state of Indiana is actively repressing people's ability to fully live lives. And that goes for people who are having abortions or need abortions, and for people who are parents, which, you know, there's a big intersection there. We live in a state that is making it too difficult, too costly, too emotionally costly to fully embody our lives and to raise families. And that's not okay. And our lawmakers need to know that. So, hope, but also rage.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Can you really place a monetary value on a musical experience like listening to John Lee Hooker play the blues? It might be difficult, but I want you to give it a try. You know what your television experience is worth. Though sometimes you might not agree when the cable bill comes every month, and if paying anywhere from $5 to $15 a month for your TV streaming experience is indispensable, how about donating a few dollars a month to the station that brings you some of the finest blues, jazz, reggae, world dance, and Latinx music? Not to mention the coverage we bring you on arts and culture. Yes, even our unique music and arts shows need your support to keep us on the air. And when you give, you too keep our fearless journalism going as well. Support independent, fearless radio. Give now at KPFK.